We're continuing our study this morning of the history and geography of the Bible. Some years ago, an old fellow was preparing to preach, and when it was time to start, he saw that there was one old cowboy that came up to hear his lesson. And he asked the cowboy, he said, "I don't know really what to do." He said, "There's so many that are gone." And the old cowboy said, "When the cows come up," and said, "if there's only a few," he said, "I always feed them." The preacher said, "Okay." So he preached his lesson. And when he was through, the cowboy said, "Well, you know, when just a few cows come up, I don't give them the whole load. But I think there's some advantage to pretending that the house is full, because you're valuable. And I appreciate you being here and your preparation and your interest in spiritual things. And we're going to pursue our study just as if the house was full. So prepare for the whole load, as they say." On page number 15 in our lesson book, we're talking about the Jordan Valley. And one of the things that we have noted about the Jordan Valley is that it runs for quite some length, and the end of the valley, as far as our study is concerned, ends at the Dead Sea, about 1,292 feet deep. The entire valley, which is referred to as the El Gor Rift, runs about 4,000 miles, quite a lengthy valley. We also note that it ranges from about 2 to 15 miles wide. We studied Wednesday night coming down through the portion of the Jordan River and through the adjacent rivers that flow into the Jordan and the Dead Sea, that there are huge cliffs on both sides, and we want to take note of those. We also noted that the flow of the Jordan River begins actually at the foot of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon to the north is a mountain that runs up over 10,000 feet in elevation. We also noted that it is quite porous, and when the waters melt or the snows melt or the rain comes, it trickles down through the rocks of Mount Hermon, creating one of the largest springs in the world that begins to formulate the beginning of the Jordan River. We noted that it ran into the Lake Hula to the north, right up here, and that lake no longer exists. It's been drained and used for cultivation. We want to note the location of the Sea of Galilee, and note that it is the deepest, in terms of elevation, the lowest, I should say, freshwater lake in the world. The Jordan River continues to flow very swiftly over a period from about Lake Hula down to, or length down to the Dead Sea, of about 200 miles, weaving its way back and forth. And from the Sea of Galilee, I believe we said, down to the Dead Sea, a distance of about 80 miles. But of course, weaving back and forth, it takes the Jordan River quite some distance to accomplish that. Running then into the Dead Sea, that we said is the lowest point on earth, 1,292 feet below sea level to the surface of it, and then about another 1,300 feet in depth. So that puts you way down below sea level. And we also wanted to note the rivers running into the Jordan River and into the Dead Sea, the Yarmouk River, just south of the Sea of Galilee. And these I want you to remember, because we're going to be having occasion to review these a bit later. The Jabbok River, about the middle of the Jordan River, and then the Arnon River running into about the center of the Dead Sea, and then the Zered River running from the southeast into the southern portion of the Dead Sea. And then we talked about the Araba as it becomes an elevation, or an increase in elevation, as it runs down further south and west into the area of our study. Now, the land very, very rugged, as we've noted. Therefore, Wednesday night, we noted that there are no villages, there are no towns in that particular area. I also want to note this before we pursue much farther in our study, and that is that the tribes of Reuben, Gad, half of Manasseh, recognized that much of the Transjordan was suitable for cattle. Now we saw when they came into that portion of the land, they wanted to dwell there and expressed that desire unto Joshua. Joshua was willing for them to have that portion of the land conditionally. Conditioned upon what? Randy? Okay, well let's turn back to the text. Joshua chapter 1. Joshua chapter 1. Joshua chapter 1. Let's begin reading about verse 12. Yes, please. Well, we have on the board through 15. That will work for our point. All right, so what was the condition? You can have it, but you've got to go fight for your brothers first and help in the conquest of all of the land, and then you have the privilege of going back. In Joshua chapter 22, we see evidence that that's what did, in fact, occur. It's interesting also to note that this Transjordan portion, especially that far into the Transjordan portion, was really not a part of the original promise that was made unto Abraham. When you read in Genesis chapter 15, beginning in verse 18, we note that the bulk of the land was to be on the western side of the Jordan, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. We now see that this is expanded into the Transjordan side. And when we get over into our study somewhat further into the book of Joshua, we will note that the tribe of Levi did not receive a particular portion of the land. They received cities, six on one side of the Jordan, and then conditioned upon the conquering of all of the land, they would receive, three on one side of the Jordan and three on the other side if indeed they took all of the land. And we see then that there were six cities of refuge that were named that belonged to the Levites, indicating that yes, indeed, they did conquer the entirety of the land and settled in it, as Joshua does declare in Joshua chapter 21, beginning in verse 43. A lot to be said about that. We'll talk more about that when we get just a little bit further along. But in this portion of our study, noting who settled where, we note that the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh were up in this area. Mesha of Moab was known as a sheep breeder. David Dixon, would you read for me 2 Kings chapter 3, please, especially verse 4. 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 4. All right, that's a whole lot of wool. But what we want to call our attention to is that this man was of Moab and living in Moab, known as a sheep breeder, tells us the kind of land that it was. It was good for livestock, and that's why that he was there. And then, of course, other portions of the land were certainly favorable for agriculture. When we turn to the book of Ruth, John, would you read for me Ruth chapter 1, verse 1 through verse 6, please? Ruth chapter 1, 1 through 6. Moab and her maiden. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They took for themselves Moabite woman as wife, All right. The Lord had given them food. Now, when we read of Ruth and her mother-in-law, when her mother-in-law desires to return home, where does Ruth go? Well, she goes with her. Now, through the series, and it's not our purpose to discuss the entirety of the book of Ruth, but we know that Ruth and Naomi came to glean in the fields of Boaz. Now, what does that tell us about this area? Ruth was there. There was much food there. When they returned to their land, there's much food there. Agriculture was a part of this country. And we want to simply take note of that in our passing. Ruth was a Moabitess, and there was food in her country. When we continue to study about this Transjordan land, Bashan, the period or the place north of the Yarmouk River, came under Syrian dominion early in Israelite history. Why is that important to our study? Number one, we know that this was livestock area, as we talk about the cows of Bashan. We also note that the significance of it being Syrian country is seen over and over and over and over again in the history of Israel. Yeah, that's right. I believe that's right. Yeah. Yes. And became a nation of people, the Ishmaelites. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah, that's right. And the Syrians appear too during this. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly right. Look at that in just a bit. But that's right, Randy. Very good observation. Yes, but offshoots of those that were not according to the plan of God to be the ones through whom the blessings would come. Yeah, exactly right. Gilead, this land south of the Yarmouk River, north primarily of the Jabbok River, became a stronghold of Israel. Now, when we talk about the land of Gilead, something should come to mind. The land of Gilead. Why is that so significant? When you think of Gilead, you think of lush, green country. You should. And as you think of those who became the enemies of God's people, you can see why. Well, we'll talk just a little bit, Randy, on your point just here, and then we'll come right back to that when we talk about the Ammonites. But the land of the Moabites, as you pointed out, these were descendants of Lot, the Moabites. Descendants of Lot. I was wrong about that. Descendants of Lot. Turn back, if you will, to Genesis chapter 19. Genesis chapter 19. And we see where that all started. Genesis chapter 19. Beginning in verse 30. Randy, would you read there through verse 38, and we'll talk about the Ammonites too while we're there. Genesis 19, beginning in verse 30. All right, that tells us the history of these two groups of people, the Moabites and the Ammonites. And so I want to say something about the Ammonites when we get just a little bit, well, when we get right there. The Ammonites, you see where they're located on our map. And you see what they had to look toward when they looked over to the people of God. They looked over to the land of Gilead, the land that was watered, the land that was somewhat lush. And then just to the east of them, what do you find? The Arabian Desert. What was it that the Ammonites had? Basically, yes. Not like what Israel had. No. So if the Ammonites looked this way, they saw desert. If they looked this way, they saw what the Israelites had. And certainly it wouldn't surprise us at all to see then why they often fought with Israel, trying to get what Israel had. They saw that as better. So when we think of Gilead, the word is used a number of times in Scripture, but there's one that comes to mind frequently in Jeremiah chapter 8, when Jeremiah is talking about the awful condition that exists among the people of God in light of their rebellion, and he said, "Is there no balm in Gilead?" The point is, here was an area that was lush, here was an area that was green, here was an area that was good, even for livestock, and there was medicine supposed to be there, but not the kind that would heal the hurt of my people, he said, because they were continually rebelling against God. I want you to see further the history of some of this area. You mentioned, Randy, the Edomites, the descendants of Esau, correctly so, as we might note in Genesis chapter 25, Genesis 32, and Genesis chapter 36. These did indeed descend from Esau. And constant battle between the Edomites and the Israelites. So you see where that war started a long time ago. Now when you think about the Edomites, south of the Zered River, that places them just next to the Arabah, just east of the Arabah, and somewhat of a desolate country. And the Edomites were known for their skill in finding water. Now that would be very handy, wouldn't it, if you lived in such a place? And so they had to do that to sustain life. Now, in our previous studies, and I want to emphasize it again here, in light of the Transjordan country, the trade routes. We've talked about the way of the sea as it would come up from the land of Egypt and pursue up the coastline through the plain of Philistia, the plain of Sharon, and the plain of Phoenicia up here on your way on up into Asia. And we've tried to emphasize the the way of Shur, because it travels along the hill country and comes up into this area and goes over east, and also goes on up as it joins the way of the sea up into the area of Asia. Now these two trade routes were absolutely essential. Look at where they come together. You can see on your map, perhaps not this one, but here's the city of Megiddo in the plains of Jezreel. And as we look at this location, we see it to be a very strategic location. That makes these trade routes all the more important. But even as we look on the Transjordan side, we see that there is a trade route that comes from the south called the King's Highway, and it goes on up into Damascus and on north of this promised land, the King's Highway. And you see why these trade routes were so very important. If we back out, If we were to back out and look at a larger map of, if we were to back out and look at a larger map of this particular area, we would find that the land of Canaan is very strategically located. I want to look at that one, and then we'll go back and start this series of maps over. But when you look at the land of Canaan, you see how important it is as far as location is concerned. If you're going to Asia, you've got to go through Canaan. Going to Egypt, if you're going in any of these directions, you have to go through the land of Canaan. Now, these trade routes, one along the sea, one along the hill country, one along the Transjordan Plateau, you see who controls this controls the commerce of the world. And consequently, we find this to be a very desirable place to dominate. And furthermore, in our previous study, we learned that God is the God of these people, and anybody who traveled through this country would know about God. And the battles that were engaged, they would know about God. The persecution for their rebellion, Israel would learn about God and God's control of this region. Now, I want to back up just a little bit to this map. Now, we're on lesson number 6 in your lesson book. Lesson number 6 in your lesson book. Now, I'm skipping over, and I'm very much aware of the questions on lesson number 5. I'm going to leave that while I'm away, and hopefully Richard will deal with at least some of that and have all the answers for you and perhaps some more questions. But as we look at lesson number 6, this is a general beginning of the study of the Old Testament lands. Now, again, our map is backed out considerably because we want to note where Canaan is again. A very small place on this map. Very small place in the world. And again, as you see it on this map, to go anywhere, you had to go through Canaan. And any map that you use, we've tried to emphasize the importance of a scale of miles. Now, some of the maps that I'm using, the scale of miles will not be accurate. Now, I've got to tell you why, because I've stretched them all out of distortion. And Richard has a word about that long to tell you what that means. In fact, I believe it was about 3 words. Just 2 words, okay. But on this map, they are somewhat proportionate to the scale of miles. And to see how small this country is, here's a scale of miles, 0 to 200 miles. Here's the land of Canaan. Just a spot on the globe, isn't it? Now, that's important to us because we want to know that when we are studying about Canaan and we study concerning the blessings that God bestows upon His people in this land, we're not talking about a great big place. In fact, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, God said to these people that I did not bless you because you were great in number, but because of the promise that I made unto your father Abraham, about 150 miles long, about 30 miles wide at the north, and about 50 miles wide from Gaza, which is about 3 miles inland, from Gaza unto the Jordan River Valley at the Dead Sea. Not a very big place. Now, you can equate that to places that you travel and note just how small that is. But it becomes the central focus of the history, for the most part, of the world, doesn't it? Now, when we talk about the land of Israel, once again, it's important that we study from an Old Testament perspective the land of Mesopotamia. We're going to be talking about the Fertile Crescent in this area, not in the desert, but in this area, the Fertile Crescent, where lands could be productive. You've talked about this, no doubt, David, in your class. The area of Mesopotamia. Now, when we talk about Mesopotamia, perhaps the two identifying landmarks would be the Tigris and the Euphrates River. These were very important rivers to that part of the country then and now. The Tigris River and the Euphrates flowed south eastward into the Persian Gulf. The Tigris is very swift and covers a period of about 1,150 miles, or a span of about 1,150 miles long. And the Euphrates River is about 1,700 miles long. Now, the Euphrates, for our purpose and study, is probably the one we're going to be emphasizing because it is included as a part of the boundaries of the land that God promised unto Abraham. Turn in your Bible to Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15. in Genesis chapter 15, beginning in verse 18. Genesis 15, verse 18. David Skinner, would you mind to read some for me, please? Verses 18 through verse 20. Excellent. We see the great river identified specifically as the river Euphrates. When we come into the conquering of the land under the leadership of Joshua, in verse 8, the text tells us, that's not the verse I'm looking for, verse 4. Verse 4, that should be. It says, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, even unto the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites and so forth, to the great sea, toward the going down of the sun. Now, as we turn to 1 Kings chapter 4, a different setting. 1 Kings chapter 4. In this setting, we're reading of the days of the United Kingdom, beginning with Saul, and then David, and now we're reading about his son Solomon. And in the days of Solomon, verse 21, it tells us that Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river unto the land of the Philistines and unto the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now, again, the significance of that is we see the river identified here as the great river Euphrates. Here in 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 21, is simply identified as the river. Now, we know what river, because this marked the northern boundary of the land that was promised unto Abraham. The river was indeed the river Euphrates, and furthermore, when it tells us that Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river, it has to be the river marking the boundary of this land. Now, I want to call your attention to one other passage relative to this, and let me find it. It escapes my memory just now. You'll find it in 2 Samuel 8, 2 Samuel 8, verse 3. In 2 Samuel 8, verse 3, should have that on the chart. It tells us during the reign of King David that he smote also Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah, and he went to recover his dominion at the river. Now, if Joshua led them into the promised land, from the river Euphrates down to the river of Egypt, and they received all of that land, as Joshua affirms that they did in Joshua chapter 21, beginning at verse 43. But then during the days of the United Kingdom, during the days of King David, it tells us that he went to recover his dominion at the river. What does that suggest occurred in the interim? They must have lost it. That's right. They lost a portion of it. And David recovered it at the river Euphrates. And then, of course, after David, his son Solomon ruled over all of that area up to the river Euphrates. Now, we're first introduced to the Euphrates in the book of Genesis, in Genesis chapter 2, in verses 8 through verse 14, where it's describing the Garden of Eden. You see that in verse 14. The river Akeldada and the river Euphrates identified in verse 14. Now, I don't know where the Garden of Eden was. All kinds of speculation about that. But we do know where the river Euphrates is. And that places the Garden of Eden generally in this area. Any questions or comments just here? Anything at all? All right. Well, I want you to see these rivers on this map, which I see that the colors are not doing so well either. This is the Euphrates River. This is the Tigris River. And, of course, they flow into the Persian Gulf. But what I wanted you to see from this map is where they originate. They originate just east of the mountains of Turkey, modern-day Turkey, and flow into or become the Tigris and the Euphrates River. All right? There we go, Turkey. The land of Mesopotamia. The word Mesopotamia literally means between the rivers, between the Tigris and the Euphrates. The term will be used to refer to the entire area reaching from the Persian Gulf to the Ararat Mountains up to the north. Now, Mesopotamia, as we consider the area just a little bit farther, Mesopotamia is never used in history to describe a nationality of people. When we look at the land of Israel, we talk about the Israelites, the Edomites, the Moabites, and so forth. We see these locations on the map, but these represent nationalities. Mesopotamia does not necessarily identify a nationality of people. Yes, yes. And again, we're going to talk about a lot of things that became a part of civilization in this area. Things that are remarkably things that we still use that are a part of civilized society. That's right. Hold that thought, if you will. I think the next chart we'll talk about some of those. But as we look at this area, it's simply describing a geographic location. The Assyrians, the Babylonians originated in this area. No, it's not the next chart. Maybe the next one. Villages began to grow in this city or in this region. Some of these villages began to elevate men to the position of kings, and they built walls around the cities. And what does that generally indicate? They needed walls for defense, which meant they also had not only defensive army but offensive weapons and armory. So they began to try to expand their borders. Now, Randy, here's the point I was looking for. In Mesopotamia, when we talk about the beginnings of what we refer to as civilization, we talk about technology, irrigation systems. It's believed the wheel was invented, metals used to make tools beginning in this area, mathematical systems. John, perhaps you still use this to talk about the divisions of a circle. Invented or at least discovered or began to be used by the Sumerians a long time ago in this particular area. And then, of course, cuneiform writing beginning, we're told, in the area of Mesopotamia. Sounds and syllables depicted with wedged shapes and characters, some dating as early, we're told, as 3000 B.C., even before Abraham. Aramean tribes developed an alphabet, making the languages easier. Aramaic became the official language of Mesopotamian empires, and here's where I want to draw your attention. Aramaic was commonly used by the Jews in captivity and often the language of Jesus and His disciples. Now, when you raise the question, in what languages are Old and New Testament text given? What languages would you name? Well, you would say Hebrew, and you would say Koine Greek, and you would have to include the Aramaic language, because certain portions of Scripture were given in Aramaic, and you can see why. It was a commonly understood and commonly used language in the Mesopotamian region early in the history of these people. Any questions or comments just here? Yes, David?
Still, Aramaic, I'm still not clear on
Well, the Hebrew language and the Aramaic language were very similar, I understand, in many respects. And not being, this is where we need Carolyn, a linguistics teacher, I'm not familiar with in what ways they're similar or how they differ or some of those particulars. Some of you might have greater knowledge of that than I do. Anyone? David, you have any information on the beginning of the Aramaic language? All I know is it began in the Mesopotamian Valley. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That may or may not answer your concerns, but that's about all I know about the Aramaic language. Here's an illustration, and perhaps you can't see that very well from where you're seated either, of the cuneiform language from the Mesopotamian Valley. Here are some illustrations of hieroglyphics, which you're probably more familiar with than you can make out on the chart up here. That's true. Yeah, that's where Genesis 9, Genesis 11, okay? That's true. The diversity of languages began there, but I'm not sure that it ended there. So the Aramaic language, from what I'm told, as far as the historical perspective, began in the Mesopotamian Valley. That's interesting. Very interesting. Where all this came from is fascinating. Now, when we get into a study of this area as well, we want to note the mountains that are there and the significance that they play in biblical history. The Sargros Mountains were parallel to the Tigris River, and they averaged about 9,000 feet in elevation. Passes, as we discussed in the land of Palestine, the land of Canaan, that these passes involved trading routes. And Randy, I believe you made the observation, or perhaps it was you, David, regarding the descendants of Noah, Noah's son Japheth. The Medes developed a civilization east of the Sargros Mountains. And you see where that's located, running just north of the Tigris River. The Ararat Mountains became quite significant, of course, as we know, concerning our study of the days of Noah and the flood. The ark came to rest on Mount Ararat. Thing that makes this interesting as well is its elevation. When we considered Mount Hermon, we said that it was nearly 10,000 feet in the northern end of the land of Palestine. But Mount Ararat is over 17,000 feet in this area north of the Tigris River. So I want you to look at this carefully. The mountain, Mount Ararat, how do I want to say that? Something to compare it to. When you go up toward north of Lone Pine, where you see the lava beds, or is it further north of Bishop? I don't remember. Those of you who've traveled up in that area and are well familiar with it, is it south of Lone Pine? You're familiar with that area. What we're talking about here is a very high and very rugged range formed mostly of lava. So it would not be very conducive to a lot of growth or agriculture, certainly at that elevation. Noah's Ark rested here. The descendants of Japheth settled north of these mountains. Here we've backed out just a little bit so you can see the area. Here's the Zagros Mountains, and here's Mount Ararat up here. Now, the reason I wanted you to see it on this map is some of the maps that we have in our lesson book that simply focus on this area don't show you the relationship of Mount Ararat to the Caspian Sea. And, of course, I think they do the relationship to the Persian Gulf as we look at the Tigris River. But this gives you a perspective as to where you are in our study. Any questions or comments just here? Okay. All right. Well, the desert. We're familiar with that. The desert. The Arabian desert. We've talked about the land of Canaan over here. We've talked about the Moabites, the Edomites, and the Ammonites, and what was east of the Ammonites, the great Arabian desert. Now, there were nomadic groups that lived in this area, but as far as large communities, there really wasn't much. Yes. Okay. All right. All right. It shows the... Yeah. Okay. You'll have to look at your book. I don't have that in this series of slides. But that's a good map to help us to understand where the descendants of Noah settled and the nations of people that ultimately... came from them. Thank you, Randy.
They overlap. You know, the book has like lines, but they overlap and intermingle and stuff. And like in Canaan, you have Ham. Originally, there, of course, in Abraham, the center of Ham. But you have some Hittites there, but Jacob, or they were there from Abraham.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Very good. All right. The Arabian Desert, you see that on the map, southwest of the Euphrates River, covers nearly 1 million square miles. Think you'd like to live there, Richard? You've lived there. Don't like it. Well, tell us about the Arabian Desert.
Now, I haven't been in the Arabian Desert, but we've lived in the Sahara and the desert, you know, around the Red Sea. And if we think that this desert out here, anywhere that we go, is barren. We haven't seen anything. There's absolutely no vegetation there at all. There's sand and the remnants of vegetation that was there from, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Sounds like a lovely place. Yeah. Yeah. Place you want to live, isn't it? Well, yes, I think our book points out that the desert is not one vast sand dune, as one might imagine. It's a high tableland with enough rainfall in the interior, it says, for some considerable population. I think that's interesting. It says modern archaeologists have found evidence that even the portion of South Central Arabia, now called the Empty Quarter, once supported major cities. I don't think you'd find that to be true necessarily now, but the central and northern sections are barren, steep, that can support only nomadic, pastoral herdsmen that raise cattle, Bedouin. So that's where that is. All right. Excellent. Our book goes on to tell us on page 24 regarding this area. It says, throughout the years of history, successive waves of Semitic people have poured out of Arabia into the fertile lands of Mesopotamia, Aram, and Canaan. About 2000 B.C., Amorites came from the desert and established city-states from Egypt to Babylon. Some 20,000 clay tablets have been recovered from the Amorite city of Mara. From about this date, the Chaldeans of Babylon came from the section of the desert just northwest of the Persian Gulf. About 500 B.C., the people, Nabataeans, I thought I had that close, moved into Edom, just south of the Dead Sea. They were a strong, resourceful people who held sway over much of North Arabia in Jesus' day. Then in about the 7th century after Christ, the Islamic people poured out of Arabia in all directions. They forced captured cities to accept their religion on the threat of death. Thus, the Arabs still play the most prominent role in the politics of the area today. Now, that speaks volumes, does it not? So we'll stop with that and begin around that point next time. Okay?